everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Phil Brining and Joe Kirk. Hello.
Hello.
This week's session was the role of the DPO, and we discussed all the different challenges that are faced by DPOs and how to combat those. And, you know, there was a lot of interaction in the chat, which was really good. But what were your highlights?
I think the conversation was really, really good, but I think there were some unanswered questions in there, in the sense that, you know, we spoke a lot about embedding culture, didn't we, and how do you do monitoring? And I think we all gave some good insights, but I don't think there's like a straightforward answer to that side of the DPO role. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
I don't think it's an overnight fix. You know, it's something that, you know, the right things to do, but it's just being patient as well. You know, time will heal, hopefully.
I think you're right, Joe. I think that was the biggest gap really in the whole session, really, was, which we talked about, was you know, is there sufficient substance to the role? Is it too airy fairy and woolly? You know, are we left to our own devices? You know, what about people that organizations that don't have to appoint a DPO? You know, what's their role? Responsibilities of a privacy officer or a privacy manager. I think that was like the elephant in the room was probably the lack of information, really, about, you know, the GDPR's got what it got, but it's quite high level.
Yeah, and it can be tricky for DPOs, especially those with, you know, that are learning in the role, to understand the wider picture of how, you know, how to ensure compliance and drive compliance within the organisation, because there are a lot of different elements to consider and a lot of different perspectives to take as well. You know, you could sometimes I'll think of a data protection related query from the perspective of, okay, does it apply with the principles? And that's one way of looking at, you know, the point in question. But then you've got to look at wider potential issues in terms of, is a DPIA required or is there any data sharing and what are the responsibilities around that? And it can get quite complicated. For the DPO alone, never mind bringing in people across the organisation to contribute.
Yeah, the discussion around kind of building culture, you know, building a strong data culture, you know, that's, you'd think that would be one of the defined responsibilities, but it's not really called out explicitly, is it? But, you know, again, people were saying, oh, that's really what I'm trying to do strategically, is to build that strong culture, because then, you know, it's going to make things easier in the long run.
But yeah. I think it'd make the DPO role less lonely as well. You know, sometimes DPO can feel like that it's them against the world or them against the organisation. I can't tell you the amount of times I've felt like a therapist talking to some customers, bless. And I understand it, you know, it can be tricky, especially when you might, well, people might feel like you're against them. And I think that's the important part here, is to make sure that they know that you know you're on their side and you're trying to work together with them.
Well, I think it was,
sorry, go on, Phil.
I was gonna say, I think it was, I'm gonna change topic, so I was gonna say, I thought the discussion about the inevitability of a conflict of interests was also, you know, pretty eye-opening, really.
I enjoyed that because it, you know,
it supported a blog you wrote.
No, I enjoyed it because I wrote a blog about it, so I feel like it's the forefront of my mind. But no, I found it interesting in writing a blog that, you know, there are so many conflicts, like you say, Phil, how do you actually avoid it? And, you know, is there a certain level where it becomes too far? You know, you're overstepping the mark and you need to reconsider whose responsibility it is to ensure, you know, enforcement of data protection or embedding of data protection within the organization.
Yeah, I think where it becomes an issue is when the conflict impacts you significantly in your role. So for example, you're a chief financial officer and you're also a data protection officer. You know, you're bound by the organization. Well, not bound, but you know, you've got to cut costs as best you can and manage money, right? And a DPO role is a big role, it's a big job, there's lots to do, lots of responsibilities, and you need, I think if you're a big organization, you need several people to buy into that and help you and to provide you with advice. So I think if you're a chief financial officer and you know you need to cut costs, how likely are you to put that infrastructure in place to support the role of a DPO? I mean, some organizations, you know, might do, but I think you're a lot less likely, and I think that's where, you know, the conflict of interest thing is, you know, an issue as opposed to kind of a conflict of interest in a sense that you're an employee and you're just conscious that you don't want to lose your job, for example.
But yes, so we'll let you watch or listen to the main session before we go down 20 more rabbit holes on this one, as it's so easy to do. But we hope you enjoy the session, and we'll be back next week on a GDPR radio.
Things. We've been on to Joe talking about a project he's doing, looking at dark web data being harvested off the dark web, and he's really quite interesting. But that caused us to go and have a look at a couple of dark websites, and of course then we had our IT guys breathing down our necks saying, what on earth are you playing at? So so yeah, it's been a really bitty week actually. They've been seem to be diving around on all sorts of things.
Feel partly responsible.
Marina sings, I am not a roper, apparently, or a robot.
Yeah, we've been working in the team on putting together a questionnaire, which I'll send a link to, actually, let me find it, for anyone to complete. It's on our website, to get an understanding of where you're at in terms of your data protection compliance internally. So it's a few questions that you answer, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, how sufficient are you or compliant are you in certain areas? And then you can get a score at the end. And if you want to discuss more about how we can help or how you can combat those, then, you know, we can reach out to you. I think you can specify that in the form as well. It takes like 10 minutes to complete, but, you know, it's quite on topic with the role of the DPO, especially for
I think it's worth looking at, Jazz. I mean, we spent a bit of time trying to get the grading right, didn't we, when we're writing the kind of a series of questions, like 20 questions or something, and then we've got different grades of answers, starting from, I don't know what you're talking about, right through to, yes, we've got policies, procedures, we've got demonstrable evidence, we've got records of training activity, in all these different topical areas. So it'd be quite interesting for people to have a look at and just kind of get their heads around where we're coming from when we're doing kind of an order or an assessment.
Yeah, I think Peter said, is there a prize for the highest score?
Definitely. Maybe have a recording of a data protection song, which has taken me at least 5 minutes to write the lyrics to earlier in the week. You can have a personalised copy, Peter.
Joe has disappeared. Hopefully he's not been kicked out. That happened to myself and Laura a few weeks back.
That was me. You two froze and then my camera turned off and wouldn't turn back on. So I don't know if that was just for me or for everybody. So I just left and come back. So yeah. I am still here.
Yeah.
Thank God.
So that question I think is quite interesting, quite potentially quite useful to just have a look at. You know, I don't think there's anything, you know, untoward of doing it, is there? You know, it's just like you work through the steps.
Oh, that's not good. Link can't open it. Is anyone else having that problem? Honestly, I swear it's always it's always me.
Well, you can sort it out. Joe, what are we talking about today then? What have you been up to this week?
Yeah, same as you really, Phil. My week's been slightly all over the place. On Tuesday, I had a discovery day with one of our customers, so my day was booked out because I was reviewing some documentation and talking to different departments within the organization just to get a bit of a feel for where they're at from a compliance perspective. And then, as you mentioned, Wednesday, Thursday, my priorities have lied with a new project that me and you are undertaking on the dark web. So that kind of involves, I think we've labeled it a DPA process, haven't we? But I think it's a little bit more than that, and it's probably not going to follow, it will follow the same sort of areas of a data protection impact assessment, but it probably won't be is what you'll typically see as a
template. Yeah.
No.
When we talk about DPAs on these type of sessions, we talk about, you know, the constraints of using, you know, a form, and I think potentially constraints thinking, you know, what we've got is more of a checklist. And you're at the point now, you're doing the investigative work, and you're gonna you've written up how you think the processing is being undertaken. Now we're literally going to step through every part of the GDPR thing. Right, how does this apply to this scenario? How does this apply to this scenario? You know, and then we think that the supplier we're working with is actually a processor. So we're really keen on how well they're protecting themselves on their contracts, their written instructions and things, privacy information they give out to their controller customers to distribute to the people whose information is getting found on the dark web through employees. So it's quite interesting bit of work, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very interesting. And it's something I've not probably been exposed to before. So it's a big learning curve at the same time. But I think I'm sure once we come to some sort of conclusion, we'll probably share our thoughts on a GDPR radio, won't we, at some point, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be interesting to get people's views, you know, and some of the assumptions we're going to have to make.
Yeah, because I think one of the sub-processors that they rely upon is an organization called Intelligent X, and they position themselves as indexing rather than processing, rather than processing data, although we're not quite sure we agree with that, but we need to do some more digging before we can come to a concrete conclusion.
We're interested, they're in Finland, aren't they? They're based in Finland and one in Prague, so they're definitely kind of an EU GDPR regulated company.
Yeah, I'll come back to you in a couple of weeks on my thoughts on that.
Yeah, very good, very good. Right, so what we...
Before we go on to the main part of the session, I just wanted to ask whether there's any news pieces that you wanted to discuss before moving on.
Yeah, I saw a news piece of an individual who was fined under the Data Protection Act 1998. So he was an individual who worked for Enterprise Rent-A-Car, and obviously they keep a record of accidents and individuals who were involved in accidents. And when he left Enterprise, he set up a law firm, solicitors, to assist with people who want to claim personal injuries. And he used the database from when he was at Enterprise to take and identify people and then subsequently contacted them to try and support them in making those claims. So he's originally ordered to pay Enterprise £300,000 in a civil settlement. He then fled the UK, went to the US back in 2016 after he was asked to appear in court. And then he subsequently came back to the UK earlier this month, I believe, and has now been fined £10,000. I think that's the first time in a long time anyway that I've seen a specific person be fined, although I guess that's because he's...
Well, not that level. They often fine, well, not often, but they fine a couple of times a year. They'll fine like medical secretaries. There was one a few months ago for accessing medical records of their neighbours and that, but not... You know, they get £200 fine or £50 fine or something.
Right, yeah. And I tried to find why it had come down from 300,000 to 10,000. Is that because the 300,000 was a civil settlement and then this one is just a fine for the breach of the law? I'm not sure. I tried to do some research, but any sort of article that I came across didn't really tell me other than it went from that to that.
I'm not really sure. I haven't seen that in the news, Joe, but I did mention to you, and I've only just remembered about this, that there was a couple of these cases a few years ago. There's two in short succession. I found a link to one of them. In November 2018, the Information Commissioner prosecuted an individual under the Computer Misuse Act. And that individual got, I think, 6 months in he got 6 months in prison, I think, for illegally accessing personal data. But somebody from the same company, which I think was Nationwide Car Rentals, he got 6 months in prison, this guy, Mustafa Kasim. But a few months before that, one of his colleagues did exactly the same, and he only got a fine. So I guess he was prosecuted under the DPA 98, which doesn't have any custodial sentences, but Computer Misuse Act does. So I'll put that link into the one that went to prison. But, it occasionally occurs, but I forgot I was meant to look at that for you.
I know this isn't, probably the correct opinion to have, but I just love the initiative. to leave one company and set up another with that database to make money off it. You can't knock that, even though what's coming to him.
If we take our data protection glasses off, maybe, yeah.
Maybe not.
Funny. I don't know if you saw it in the news. The High Court has asked a judge to unmask hackers to unmask themselves and return or delete stolen data. So they don't no idea who these people are. Russian cyber gang Quillin, who apparently attacked NHS and stole more than 100,000 patients' records. So Mrs. Justice Stacey, a couple of days ago, issued an order against persons unknown. Then they're required to provide their full names and addresses to allow for legal documentation to be served on them.
How on earth are they going to follow that up?
Well, I mean, who's going to comply with that? Anyway, that was just interesting to see, and that was reported in the London Standard. I don't know if you saw there was a phishing attack this week on public authorities, which affected a few housing associations, including the Bolton and Salford Council systems for registered interest in social housing. That was reported. It was a third party company called Locator that runs these websites that got attacked, and it caused a big problem. So they've had to take all their systems down a couple of days ago. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I didn't see it.
No. One thing I did see, though, actually, I think yesterday the ICOs released a statement regarding Meta's ad-free subscription service. I think I meant last week, wasn't it? I mentioned in the news that this. I've noticed a couple more news outlets that have started to do the pay or consent or pay method in relation to targeted ads. So the ICOs come out and said they've released a statement saying that one of their key priorities is to ensure that people's information rights are upheld by the online advertising industry. Earlier this year, we ran a call for views on consent or pay models in which service users pay a fee to not be tracked for online advertising. We are considering the responses received and will, sorry, reading a statement and it's this a bloody chatbot keeps coming up in the way. Sorry, apologies, guys. What did they say? It said they're considering the responses received and will set out the ICO's position later this year. So that'll be something to keep an eye on. I'm sure that will develop. I'm not sure I would say quickly, but don't know if these things are quickly, are they really?
No. I saw, we mentioned a few weeks or months ago about this key card cloning vulnerability that's been reported, and there's quite an interesting article in Wired about that, because they've been working hard, this company that supplies these key cards, HID Global, they've been working hard on trying to get some fixes, but they're still recognizing this as a real major vulnerability, like millions of key cards being able to be cloned by being close proximity to them and then reading them and then writing out alternative cards. So I'll put that in the link because it's quite interesting. I mean, people might be using these for access control systems and things.
Mm.
I'll just go and find it and put it in the link.
Okay. Well, while you do that, it is quarter two, so let's move on to the main part of the session, which is why everyone is here, the role of the DPO. I mean, it's not as simple, you know, as it sounds, I don't think. I think the DPO can form many different types of people, really. So, you know, it can be part of somebody's obligations. It can be, It can be, that's off-putting. I'm terrible at multitasking. It can be part of somebody's other responsibilities. It can be their main focus. You know, a DPO could be that for a whole group of organizations or just a singular one. It's quite complicated. You know, we act as outsourced DPOs, and all of these bring their own challenges, I'm sure people want to discuss. So feel free to add your questions into the chat, but I want to get your thoughts
and your observations. Yeah, and your observations.
Yeah, because I'm sure there'll be a lot of relatable discussions had today. But yeah, I want to get your thoughts on your experiences as DPOs, I suppose.
I'll let Phil go first because he's got more experience than me.
You know, you're right. It varies from scenario to scenario. So we're working as a DPO for some organisations, and the real challenge isn't the UK GDPR. It's the international dimensions. And I was interested in reading something today, I think, in Lexology. It was just running through Nigerian Data Protection Act and the obligations imposed in it. And I noted the mandatory annual audit is required, as well as the DPOs are obliged to raise awareness of data protection within their various organizations and amongst their vendors, partners and third party service providers. So what, you know, we might think we've got it cracked, you know, when we're got the UK GDPR cracked, but you know, there's always potential those other dimensions. We talked about that with this client you're working on the dark web, you know, Joe, you know, if they're starting to take on contracts and they're monitoring behavior, which is potentially what they're doing, you know, in other territories, then they've got to be aware of that. So I think that, you know, what the GDPR says and what the ICO says, I found a very interesting thing about on the government advice to school DPOs, which I'll come on to hopefully during the session. But I think it can be quite tough, Jazz. It depends on a lot of scenarios. Is it a voluntary post? Mm. You know, is it a mandatory post? What's the industry? What's the nature of the processing activities? You know, what's the territorial reach of it? I think, you know, it's quite, I think it can be quite a lot broader than just what the GDPR defines.
Yeah. James has said in the chat, my previous role as a DPO was subsumed into a legal role. A solicitor took the position. To me, this is a huge conflict of interest. A solicitor has a responsibility to their client, not to data subjects,
That's a really good point.
I wrote an article a few weeks ago. I've mentioned it a couple of times now, but it's quite relevant today, obviously, on the role of the on conflicts of interests in relation to the role of the DPO. And I initially wrote one relation to two organizations that had a financial director as the DPO or intended DPO. And then I thought I may as well broaden the advice or the guidance piece to different types of conflicts of interest. And it almost left me thinking, you know, who is there actually to take on this role, you know, as without it just being their sole role. Because the head of HR came, I was looking on the ICO's website, was saying, you know, any senior management really, like head of HR, head of IT, head of finance, any chief, you know, or managing directors and whatnot. And it was, you know, it kind of just left you thinking who would be there to take it, because on the other end, lower operational level people weren't advised to take on the role because they're, you know, much more involved in day-to-day processing as well. So it's quite complicated.
I don't think you can ever get away from the fact that there has to be at some point a conflict of interest. You know, the DPO, you know, is if they're an employee, you know, there might be concerns about their employment. If they're an external contractor, maybe they're worried about losing the contract, you know, the financial implications of that. When they're getting involved in advising on DPAs, for instance, you know, who's marking that homework? You know, I think it's quite inevitable that a DPO is going to have at least some conflict of interest, I think.
Yeah, I think I came to some sort of conclusion that even where there is one, I think there's levels to it. But like you say, you can't always avoid it. And where you can't, you've got to recognise that and put in any mitigating steps. And I think, for example, one of those is maybe having a team behind you that you can, you know, gauge other people's opinions on, so it's not affecting how you advising and monitoring on the law.
Bill, yeah. I want to touch on a conflict of interest you mentioned there about kind of, you know, if you're an employee and you're slightly worried about, you know, losing your job perhaps. But when I was doing some research for this, for the podcast, I had a look on the ICO's website and, you know, what they consider, I guess what they consider best practice. And they said that the DPO operates independently and is not dismissed or penalized for performing their tasks. Have you ever come across or heard of anybody that's kind of lost their job for, you know, just doing their job of advising on the law?
There was a guy in Germany, wasn't there, who got dismissed, but that was because he had a conflict of interest. I think he was the chairperson of the Workers' Council or something, and also the DPO, and he got dismissed. And I think it was because his employer thought he had a conflict of interest. He thought it was, you know, they were just using that as an excuse. But I've not seen anything over here, you know, in the UK where the ICO said, you know, it seems like you have got a conflict of interest. I mean, they've said generically, we think that these types of roles might have a conflict of interest, but I've not seen anybody being singled out.
And I think something that is also, I know it's quite interesting, but I do have some sort of sympathy for some organisations, because, you know, if you're a small organisation and, you know, there's only four or five people and you have to have someone as a named DPO, some organisations are kind of left up to no choice to have some sort of clash of, you know, a DPO and a role such as chief financial officer, because you have to have somebody
senior person.
And, you know, if you're a small organization, there's 6-7 of you, you're not really left a choice. And if you're limited resources, then, you know, you can't necessarily hire somebody to have that role just specifically to be a DPO. And I guess if you're a small organization, you could perhaps argue that there's not really too much going on from a personal data perspective. I know that's obviously contextual depending on the organization. But if you're a startup, you know, you're quite new. There's not be too much going on, I wouldn't have thought. I mean, I've got no real experience of owning an organization and starting one up. But, you know, I do have some sort of sympathy for some organizations. It is quite tricky, isn't it, to kind of balance it. And I mean, I guess maybe then at that point, it's identifying the person who would have the least amount of conflict with the role of a DPO.
Or maybe you have to split responsibilities and split the role up into different pieces, you know, and you know, have a look at the duties and you know, divide the responsibilities out to try and mitigate as much as you could. But I mean, you could imagine small charities, you know, resources might be tight, you know, small schools, you know, where there's a requirement to put in a data protection officer, and yet, you know, relatively small employee pool to choose from.
James has said, whereas I am the registered DPO with the ICO, we have a DPO roles document and delegate responsibilities across the team and have a RASCI in place, RASCI.
Roles, responsibilities, I can't remember. It's a matrix, isn't it? A RASCI matrix.
Yeah, he said, this is also looking to avoid conflict of interest as my responsibilities are also aligned to a chief privacy officer. To avoid conflict of interest, we also ensure the business ultimately makes the final decision and we ensure we inform and look to be as objective as possible.
Yeah, I think a lot of this, you know, to me, it's the character of the individual is also very, very important. You know, so you might be an individual with some degree of conflict of interest, but be better equipped to, I won't say deal with it, but, you know, it less likely to affect the outcome. It's really hard to kind of articulate that, you know, some people might have the character, strength of character, experience, etc., to be able to compartmentalize bits of their job and be self-critical and say, actually, you know what, that is wrong. You know, yes, it was my idea, but it is wrong. So, you know, I think as a general rule of thumb, you don't want the conflict of interest. But, you know, if you are in that situation where you can't, it's unavoidable, then what are we going to do to make sure that the individual who's incumbent in the post is best supported as they can be in the role?
And on that, I want to get your thoughts, because I've been in conversations with a customer this week and I suppose their DPO or head of governance, whatever you would like to call her, she left, leaving two members of the data protection team there. And one of them has been with the organisation for 2 weeks. So the other one, he, you know, he's very much involved in data protection, but it's not his only responsibility. And I don't know if he can handle it, to be honest, just with how much work he's got to do. So he's wanting to do SARS training for staff across the organisation, 10 different members of staff in each department or in various departments that handle personal data, so they can redact their own SARS. And I know that, you know, delegating responsibilities is probably necessary in a lot of instances, but as soon as I heard that, alarm bells rang, and I want to get your thoughts on that. Is it necessarily a bad thing if they are trained up? Can you trust them? You know, what if they leave? There's all these things at play. I don't know if I'm just being negative or what, pessimistic.
The first thing that came to my mind is that if they're doing their own SARS in terms of, like, from a department perspective, and something comes in that involves them, and that, you know, they're probably more likely to redact it out. Although I guess the DPO would probably be the person who would complete, like, maybe if they have like an internal QA process, to go back through and just say, okay, look, you've took this out, but I think, you know, they're well within their right to have access to this. So I guess I've answered my own question there, that it could have issues, but you know the person who's, you know, the DPO will probably have to have final say, I guess, of, you know, what they should and shouldn't disclose.
Well, you say that, Joe, but you and I were on a pre-audit meeting, weren't we, yesterday, was it? With a very big international charitable organisation, and they have an extremely similar organisation that is, you know, does exactly what they do, but is different, right? So you've got, without saying who it is, it's hard to say, but you've got this massive charitable organization with a whole host of processing of children's data. And then you've got another one that does exactly the same. They're about the same size, been around for about 100 years or so. One of them, who we're going to audit, said, well, what we do is we centralize all SARS. All SARS are coming through our divisions and regions and units get channeled up to us in HQ and we deal with them. The other organization doesn't. It distributes out. So you basically got these voluntary leaders of these small organizations dealing with SARS, you know, locally. I think that's dangerous. And actually, the people we're talking to, our client, they thought it was dangerous. Well, they wanted our opinion. And I said, well, how are you going to manage consistency? How are you going to make sure that it's all being done, you know, correctly? It's hard if it's all distributed out. You're so reliant on people's knowledge levels, you know, skill, diligence, attention to detail, and understanding of what is personal data. So I would have alarm bells ringing as well.
Yeah. And that's the thing as well, a lot of the time with the assigned, you know, responsible person. That gave me flashbacks to the DPDI bill then, senior responsible individual. But I've lost my train of thought now. Oh yeah, their level of knowledge and expertise, you know, it's a requirement under the GDPR for the DPO to have that knowledge and the skill and the expertise, but it's not always there. And you know, if that's then being passed down onto other members of staff, then it's, you know, especially if you can't approve training by board, you know, when it comes from the top down, it can cause a whole heap of issues.
Yeah. Yeah, I've just seen this in the chat about this ICO paper. It's a bit heavy reader. I'm not seeing it. I put in a link to something that I thought was quite interesting on the government website about DPOs in schools, because it sets out, you know, the responsibilities of a DPO in a school, which is good, because you know, we're often getting hung up on monitoring. You know, what is monitoring? You know, for me, monitoring is, you know, compliance checking and, you know, those kind of activities. Now, I see on their website says that the DPO's minimum task is to inform and advise the controller about their obligations to monitor compliance, including internal protection activities, data protection activities, advising on impact assessments, training staff, conducting internal audits, and being the first point of contact for data subjects and the commissioner. So that whole kind of monitoring, you know, what is monitoring? You know, how are we doing monitoring? Does it vary from place to place? You know, how often are we monitoring? What are we monitoring? We're recording the results. What we're doing is when we're finding things that are not what we want, you know, in terms of issuing corrective actions. I'm interested in how that whole monitoring piece is getting controlled.
I mean, in my mind, it'd be how we approach it. So, you know, separate it per month, in maybe a topic per month or a couple of topics per month, and review what documentation you've got in place around that. Check whether it's actually happening in practice, and maybe report on that as well. Look at, say, for example, if you're looking at breaches, review how many breaches you've logged in maybe the past year, if it's on an annual basis, or the past quarter, or however you want to separate it out, and see what you can be doing to improve on, you know, to reduce the number of breaches, if there's been mitigating steps that have actually been implemented. So, you know, there's the documentation side, and then there's the practical side, and cross comparing, really.
Jay, you got any thoughts? Your monitoring stuff?
I'm quite new to it, so I've had things that have kind of gone through my mind. I mean, I'm just sat thinking as I'm listening to Jasmine talk about, you know, dipping in and out of things, you know, maybe once a quarter or once a month. I think monitoring to me, I mean, if you just look at monitoring itself, is like frequent checking, I think, and like observing. So I think it also had to include perhaps maybe, you know, as a DPO, jumping into meetings and looking at what the organization's actually doing and seeing if they're applying what they're learning. And I think that will also then give you a better knowledge as to, you know, the sort of things that you're implementing around processes and procedures and training, you know, whether they're actually up to the standard that they need to be. Cause, you know, because you're seeing it in person, you know, rather than kind of just looking back at a procedure and then maybe talking to people. And I think if you talk to somebody and ask them, you know, do you understand, you know, the processes and procedures that we're doing, they could lie. I think seeing it in person is probably the best thing to do. So I think perhaps maybe if you're monitoring an organization and what they're doing, I think, you know, getting in and amongst it is probably the best thing that you could do.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen that happen in some of my customers where the culture has improved massively just through the DPO being so, so present, you know, across the organization, the organization within each department. And like you say, you know, tapping into certain meetings, hosting workshops and things like that, just letting the organisation know that they are a friendly face, you know, they're not just a blocker as people can sometimes see, and people are then more willing to work with you than against you. Because I suppose as well with the role of the DPO, there's two elements of it. There's the proactive side and the reactive side. And sometimes, you know, you can be in a constant state of firefighting, especially when it's only part of, you know, your wider responsibilities, to the point that the proactive work and, you know, the proactive monitoring and updating your measures and so on can suffer.
Yeah, so you kind of your buzzwords were, you know, present, positive, proactive, you know, accessible or available, you know. So if your DPO is in that kind of, you know, they're there and they're in amongst people, then they're more available to bounce ideas off. They'll probably see more people, ask them more questions. I think it's, yeah, I think you're right.
I mean, one of the things I was just chatting to Joe then. I felt like we was actually getting tested. We passed.
And one of the things that, again, this is kind of more aspirational, I suppose, that how are you monitoring that your privacy notices are right? You know, what are you doing about transparency? Are you going out and asking the data subjects, or are you reading them yourself and thinking, no, that looks about right, you know, nothing's changed there? Because I'm a great advocate for saying, well, you know, in an ideal world, we would have like a focus group of representative, you know, service users or customers, whatever. And we would be asking them, you know, what does this mean? What does that mean? Because do you remember we talked a few weeks ago that the vast majority of people going to various studies don't understand the privacy information. They don't understand the terminology and things. So that transparency one's always an interesting one about, you know, what are we doing to try and make sure that things are transparent, you know, checking.
I think talking to data subjects is a really good idea to understand whether your privacy information is, you know, doing what it's meant to be doing. And, you know, but I guess, although if you do speak to somebody and you say, you know, do you understand? They might say no, but that's not necessarily because it's, you know, it's not good enough. It might just because they've just not read it.
Yeah. I mean, when we're doing this audit, Joe, this organization just mentioned, you know, their principal service users are aged between 4 and 18. So when we were talking to them on the phone, we said, well, you know, we've at the moment got an expectation that you'll have different privacy notices for different bands of data subject. You know, you've got the parents and the carers, you've got the volunteers, you've got the donors, you've got the fundraisers, and then you've got the service users who are aged between 4 and 18. You know, well, what do you provide for the under-12s? What do you provide for the over-12s?
Yeah, have you ever,
interesting to see.
I don't think I've ever come across a child's privacy policy, if that's what you want to call it.
Oh, yeah, could you imagine doing a fantastic animation?
I think that would probably make most sense, wouldn't it? Talking them through it and, you know, rather than necessarily writing them a policy for them.
Well, what's the point in writing a complicated policy?
Oh, do you know what? We can use that book that you bought. What was that? What was it called?
Was Haro?
No, Waro.
Waro.
Oh, right.
Was that regarding to privacy information? I can't remember. It was to do with data protection, wasn't it?
It was an educational piece. Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, we've been suggested we check Legos out. That I'm quite keen
I'm
to
just
do
getting
that.
It up now.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I've got the right one here though.
I'm intrigued. Legos child privacy policy.
Yeah.
Nothing like on time, on air research.
No. So yeah, what else are we meant to be talking about today? So building a culture, you know, building the culture, you know, navigating the complexity. We said in the blurb, didn't we? We're going to talk about defining the DPO role and responsibilities, navigating the complexities of the relationship between the DPO and the business. We've really touched on that a little bit, haven't we? About the conflict of interest and trickiness of relatively large and small organisations. But yeah, building the culture is one of the primary goals, isn't it? Because that's a strategic move. If you can get, you know, distribute out awareness and responsibility and, you know, embed that in their business, then you long run, saving yourself a load of time or doing yourself out of a job, whichever way you look at it.
Yeah, it can be tricky, but it's one of those. I think it's down to momentum as well. You know, you need to keep pushing, keep being at the forefront of people's minds, and then gradually people will start to shift, especially where that culture wasn't previously there. I mean, I've seen it even in staff having their own way of using systems, you know, their own saving mechanisms and all sorts. You know, they'll they'll save things in their own local hard drive and or OneDrive or whatever, and just it's because what it's what they've always done. And you know, you can tell them one time you need to change that, and then they'll probably just ignore you. They'll say yes and then carry on. But if you keep pushing at it and, you know, explaining the reason for it, and just I think keeping people informed on what your goals are, you know, in relation to the organization can help. And just treating people as if they're, you know, on the same level as you, as if they, you know, it's a mutual agreement, really, it can help, rather than just saying, can you do this, please do this, please do this. We're trying to improve our compliance because it doesn't always get through to people.
Yeah,
I think this Lego one. Yeah, sorry, go on, Phil.
I was going to say, this Lego looks really good. But have you seen EasyJet? I don't know if they still do, but they used to have a flight attendant doing the privacy notice.
No, I've not seen that.
It was just like the safety check. I'll try and find it, because again, that was really good. It's very inventive, quite engaging.
Yeah, something a little bit different, isn't it, than just reading a 6-7 page document. I mean, some price policies are 30-odd pages. Not sure why, probably maybe. Quite a few in one, but yeah, no one really wants to sit and read a 10-page document of what's going on, do they really? A video is a lot better.
You were going to say something before I rudely interrupted you.
I was. It was on what Jasmine. What were you talking about, Jasmine? I can't remember. My mind's gone blank.
Culture, and you know.
Yes. Yeah. I think something that would help a DPO is being personable to the people that, you know, because you're trying to get people to buy into, you know, not your job, but, you know, the things that you're trying to relay. So I think being personable and approachable will probably go a long way. You know, if you're sending these things out and you're asking people to change things, you know, I think it's about building the relationship with your colleagues. If you, I know it's quite hard if you're, you know, an organization that's got thousands of colleagues, but especially if you're a smaller organization, you know, you start to get to know people. And then when you start to send these updates around and kind of, you know, asking people to do these things, it's, I think someone's a lot more likely to do that if you've got that relationship with them.
Yeah, I think that can be trickier, especially, you know, where you've got a DPO who's overseeing a group of events, you know, of organizations of different entities, because while it might ensure that, you know, processes are standardized across a group, surely they can't get around, you know, all of the little issues that turn into that if you turn a stone and you know there's loads of worms underneath, then, you know, it can be harder to find. So I want to get your thoughts on that as well.
Now, DPOs. One of the things that I think to pick up on is, you know, monitoring.
Yeah.
What's up?
No, I just asked a question. It's all right.
Oh, sorry. What was your question?
Just, I want to get your thoughts on group DPOs, because I was giving it some thought. And on the one side, it can be good for, you know, making sure that all practices are standardized across each organization. But then on the other side, it can be really difficult to understand where the issues are in each different entity, you know, and really get involved in each individual organization.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the size of the group, doesn't it? You know, whatever they've got as a structure below the DPO, you know, might have data champions in place, you know, to help and to act as the eyes and ears. Not really sure, I have to think about that one. But I wanted to talk about, you know, kind of an aspect of monitoring must be about measuring. So, you know, what are we monitoring and what we're doing about it? You know, when we're finding things like you mentioned about,
breaches.
You know, breaches or bad practices or people, you know, not doing what you've asked them to do, you know, how are you measuring the number of times that occurs, and how are you plotting progress, I suppose, is my question. You know, if you've got these APIs, you know, and you're saying, well, you know, this month we had X, you know, number of these occurrences, and then next month we had Y, and then the following month we had Z, you know, monitoring is not just looking at stuff in the here and now, is it? Surely we're then proactively applying corrective actions and mitigations to try and change culture, improve things, reduce the instances of these, what we might call non-compliances or non-conformances coming through. You know, we're just getting interested to see what people are measuring. You know, one of the things I bang on about is the number of hours of training, for instance, delivered in data protection. So you'd want to see that, you know, I would want to see that as a number.
Yeah, it's worth saying, actually, on point of training, if anyone is interested, if, you know, they're worried about their level of knowledge as a DPO or data protection manager, we do have a course that is starting next month on the 10th of September. So if anyone wants further information on that, I'll just put a link in the chat. But yeah, sorry to bombard that. Carry on.
No, that was it, really. My chat seems to have stuck. But anyway, so yeah, it's just that kind of that I was just interested in what people had to say or think about, you know, what we're doing when we're monitoring, what we're measuring, and how are we recording that, how we acted upon it. You know, is it something that has got, you know, visibility at senior management level, or is it just tucked away in the DPO's, you know, own workbooks?
I guess it's quite hard to quantify, isn't it, some things? And I think it's that kind of the point that you're making, like, you know, if you're doing drop-ins with people and you want to, you're asking them questions to understand their knowledge, you know, for example, to see if your training is sufficient, then is that the point you're trying to make, Phil, that it's quite hard to quantify how that would look and how it would progress over time?
The point I'm making really is, you know, I'm sure everyone here has got it, but, you know, you've got to pick some key performance indicators, I think. You've got to pick some measures, you know, but what are they? You know, the number of times that somebody's report, you know, the number of people reported for leaving their desks unattended, their keyboards unlocked. You know, if that's what you're trying to measure, how are you getting that information intelligence back from the workplace? You know, there might be a tendency to not report stuff if they know that it's being watched. You know, I don't know. I'm just kind of throwing it out there. As we talk about monitoring compliance, what does that actually mean? You know, we must be wanting to quantify stuff.
No, I think you make a good point of raising that, because, you know, it can be something that's overlooked. You know, if you're checking, okay, you've had this many breaches last quarter, or, you know, this many rights requests, or we've been this proactive in this area, etc., then what are you doing with that information moving forward? Are you going to use it in any way to carry on improving? Or are you just taking it as it is and then moving on to the next thing? It's that's where the proactiveness comes in, probably more than ever, in terms of, you know, driving compliance, rather than just checking to see where you're up to at that moment in time, you know, how you can improve moving forward.
Yeah. That's what has struck me about this thing I mentioned about the Nigerian, you know, Data Protection Act, with this annual audit. It's saying the mandatory annual audit only provides a snapshot of an entity's level of compliance at a specific point in time. But if you're doing that using the same measures over and over again over the course of years, you should be able to see some progress, shouldn't you? You should be able to see that compliance is more overt and it's more readily the thing that happens first, you know. And at once, you know, what point do we... When we're doing audits, you know, we can come to the data protection by design by default, and like, well, how, and some, to some extent, accountability, you know, how are we getting the grip of this accountability? We recommend people look at the accountability framework the ICO has published, which is okay, you know, but with data protection by design and by default, you know, apart from the Spanish regulator, the APD's seven principles paper that they've published, which is pretty good. You know, it's a bit of a concept, isn't it? And at some point, you know, we would, as auditors, Joe, we're going to say, well, you know, we can't find any evidence of this in being in place. Therefore, as far as we're concerned, it isn't in place, you know, and it's an obligation. And, you got to move on from, because at the moment, the audits still are very focused on your ROPAs aren't right, your privacy notices aren't right. You know, it's a really elementary stuff still isn't right. Yeah, but we want to get that right and move on to the more complicated, you know, stuff that's inherent, you know, like zero tolerance culture, you know, cultural stuff, privacy by default and by design. That's what we want to see in place, isn't it? You're going to love the lyrics of my song, you know, later on. It's fantastic.
Is it to do with data protection by design and by default, is it, Phil?
I don't know. Couldn't possibly.
Rumbled, yeah. you are right, though. It is quite tricky, isn't it, to kind of quantify data protection by design and by default and how that looks. And I think, could you maybe perhaps class auditing as monitoring? Do you think going off piste
No, I think definitely, you know, that's a feature of monitoring is an audit, isn't it? Or a compliance check. It could be a spot check, you know, that you get people to perform every now and again. But you know, again, I'm not sure an audit is a one-off annual exercise either. Ideally, it's a rolling program, you know, and it's looking at things more frequently than an annual basis.
I mean, so then
particularly fast-moving things.
could you not tie in the task of doing your monitoring is to, you know, completing your audits that you do throughout the year? I know an audit's not a it's not a legal requirement, is it? But it's considered best practice, and it allows you to understand where you were at and where you are now. And it obviously covers, depends on how much detail you're going to, but it should cover every facet of data protection. So, I mean, do they not kind of intertwine together that, you know, as a DPO, as you're doing your monitoring, that you're also kind of auditing the organization as you go?
Well, I think you are. I guess that's part of what the point I have badly articulated is that, you know, monitoring is observing, isn't it? It's looking at, you know, measuring against the expected behaviors. So, you know, that would include, definitely would include auditing and compliance checking. I'll tell you one thing that strikes me. Sorry, we'll come back.
No, go on.
Joe, is looking at some of the other data protection law around the world that, you know, we're now seeing emerge after the GDPR, like the Nigerian, like the Jamaican, they're taking it a bit further, I think. You know, the fact that in Nigeria there is a mandatory annual audit, the fact that in Jamaica there's a mandatory annual return that has to be submitted to the commissioner. You know, when the GDPR, you know, and look at the last government, you know, critical about all the red tape, but, you know, I'm not convinced that the GDPR is now the gold standard of law. The key thing is how well these pieces of legislation are implemented in the various locations. You know, it's all right having it written down, but if it's not implemented by a regulator, then it's just words on a page, isn't it?
I suppose it can't be that hard to, I suppose, do better than the ICO in that instance, though.
Jasmine, you're so cruel.
you know, it's not the biggest challenge, yeah. I don't think. So,
but you know, arguably, it's now not that gold standard. There are data protection laws in other territories that do go further. You know, defined custodial sentences. Yeah, and these requirements, I think, you know, like the, you know, annual returns and audits. I think they're good things to put in.
I wish we had it here, because I mean, I was talking to, it happens quite often, you know, I'll be talking to customers and they'll have data protection audits, but it'll be part of their internal auditing program, and it'll be on a biannually or every 3 year basis, or, you know, and I just think that so much can change in that time. And, you know, if something's going under the radar from a couple of months after your first one, and you know, it's not going to be picked up on again for the next couple of years, then it concerns me.
Mm.
So, yeah, I would welcome that in the GDPR.
I know, but it might, I would have to check some of the early drafts. It might have been in there and taken out. I can't remember now.
Why, though? I don't know why they would take that out.
Well, some political levers somewhere, I guess. But Jamie's saying that, you know, spends a lot of time, you know, doing detailed reporting and analysis and a rolling program internal audits. So I think it's exactly where we need to be with things, you know. But that's a time-consuming process, and, you know. But I think ultimately that is the key to changing behaviour and culture. You know, is being, like you said, Jasmine, being out there and in amongst people. And helping them to, you know, achieve what you're trying to achieve.
So doing what Jamie's doing then is obviously excellent, right? But what about in the instance where you're a data protection officer on your own and you don't really have the resource around you to do the other bits of the job, you know, the admin side of things, like the building of a ROPA and maintaining that, and carrying out data protection impact assessments, and
I think it's tricky. You know, you're maintaining, or if you, let's say that you're responsible for maintaining the ROPA as a data protection officer, you know, well, you then reliant on people telling you from within the business operations that, you know, that something has changed, or that there is a new processing activity that they're undertaking, or, you know, there is a change in processor and therefore an international transfer, or the retention period might have been adjusted, or a different class of data is being collected, or something.
Or that they've told you everything. You know, this could be things being left out.
Yeah, so, you know, you only are as good as the people that, you know, you got around you, and that's why I think building, you know, changing behaviour is strategic and critical.
Yeah, I think you come across some smaller organisations where they might not have everything written down, but they do have that awareness of, you know, being careful with people's information, keeping it in secure places, etc. I've had conversations with people before where I don't know that I don't mean this in a negative way. You know, they're trying to justify what they do have in place to make up for what they do in practice to make up for what they don't have documented. And it, you know, while it's not the gold standard or necessarily compliant
do you think there's sufficient information around about the role and responsibilities? Do you think it's too woolly and watered down? Do you think it would benefit from much more definition around, right, you know, you're on the hook for this and this, rather than monitoring compliance? You know, would it be better? And what about those people that aren't DPOs but are privacy managers or privacy officers? You know, do the same rules apply? You know, have they got different rules that apply to them? You know, is that more accountability framework? How does that sit? Accountability framework, how does that sit with the monitoring compliance and what's in the GDPR?
I suppose where you've got a privacy officer or a data protection lead, you know, you're not required to have a DPO. That, under the eyes of the law, that means that processing is less risky, I suppose. You know, it doesn't mandate the need or warrant the need for a DPO. So any issues around that would be lesser than they would for organisations that need one. And I suppose that's the view the ICO would take. Not to say that there is no risk there. Obviously, there's still an importance to have somebody responsible for data protection, but I suppose that's the only difference that you can really take out of a privacy officer and data protection officer, because they should really be doing the same things, ideally.
Yeah, but do you think it's adequately defined? Do you think the ICO has gone far enough in helping us to understand the role, the responsibilities, the duties, the tasks?
I mean, trying to navigate the ICO's website, I think that will provide you with your answer, because it's not straightforward. No, it takes time to understand the whole picture of, you know, data protection and your responsibilities within it. It can be difficult to get your head around, and I think there are probably limited resources out there to tell you what the whole picture is. I think, you know, in our audit reports, I used to base it off that for quite a long time, and in terms of the different areas that you look at. And then obviously that document that I put together on the road to data protection compliance, it's like, it's 10 main areas that you need to focus on. It's not exhaustive, you know, it doesn't include direct marketing in it, for example, but it includes the main points to consider. And there's limited resource out there, I would say, that gives you that holistic picture.
Yeah.
In an easily digestible way, you know.
Yeah. I think Steve, a very astute observation, you know, what is large scale processing, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely to the key. I mean, my view is, you know, if you were to kind of mark the GDPR and all the guidance, you know, like homework and that, you would, the comment would be 5 out of 10 could do better. That's what my comment would be.
Just go into that large scale processing not being defined. Do you think, I think that might be like quite a lot of stuff in the GDPR left intentionally woolly, so that organizations are sat thinking, are we considered large scale processing? You know, I think we should take a risk-based approach and say that we are, so that then that they're somewhat forced to appoint a DPO, you know, they're kind of pushed into that direction, because we're not actually sure what large-scale processing is. We might be considered large-scale processing. Let's err on the side of caution and say that we do, and therefore appoint a DPO. So I think that's why they do it that way, or that it's just quite hard to quantify what large-scale is.
I think when they were envisaging, again, when they've been envisaging writing this in law, you know, is something that was a marked step up probably from the directive, and there wasn't, like, other territories have got the GDPR to look at and the guidance to look at and say, well, they haven't really quantified this large scale, so we're going to put some lines in the sand. But the fact that the law is designed to try and regulate just about every organization across the continent in all processing activities, whether it's commercial, third party, public sector, you know, third sector, whatever, I think it is quite hard to put a line in the sand and say, you know, this is large scale, because the context, as we say often, is absolutely crucial. You know, 100,000 records of a particular type of data is potentially large scale, you know, compared to 10,000 of a different type of data, or 1,000 of a different type of data, or 100. You know, if you're looking at, if you say, well, the line in the sand is 10,000 records, and you've got a sexual health clinic that only has 100 patients, well, they're never going to bust that level, but it still might be higher risk processing. Now they might get caught by something else in there, but I think it was deliberately left vague to try and get the supervisory authorities to start saying, actually, in this country, in this territory, in these use cases, this is our opinion. But that hasn't really come out yet, has it? Well, the European Data Protection Board, the WP29, did put some measures in place, like, you know, we think a city level processing in a transportation network is large scale. You know, we think a hospital is large scale, but a doctor isn't probably large scale. They have got some definition in their guidance, haven't they? But it's still quite vague.
I think the GDPR does need to be vague in some level, because the landscape is, you know, it's always changing. It's changing so quickly. So it needs to survive, you know, through the different
that's a good point,
the different areas.
That's a good point. You know, if you'd written this, you know, before big data came along, you know, it might be totally different concept of what is large scale, you know. So you make a good point, Jasmine, that it has to has to have longevity to it.
Now we've got 2 minutes left, so I want to pose a question. It's not really a question, what do you think the future of the role of a DPO looks like now? I know the answer could have been very differently if, you know, in an alternate universe and the Tories had stayed in power, that the DPO would have ceased to exist and they would be a senior responsible individual. But how do you two and the listeners see the
wishful
future
thinking
role of the DPO adapting and moving with the times?
Jamie says better paid. We'll all take that one.
Yeah, definitely. What do you think, Jasmine, what's the future of the DPO?
Thanks for putting me on the spot with that one. What do you think, Josin, as though you've given this
you
some thought?
You can't Uno reverse me.
Listen, we've got 1 minute and then it's barbecue time.
I think I can't see much changing, really. You know, I can't see new guidance coming out, you know, changing things around.
I think AI will form much more of a role in the wider role of the DPO. I think it'll be quite relevant, and whether we like it or not, it will be something that we need to get our heads around more and more, and it will fall within the DPO's responsibility more and more. Obviously, there's relevance to IT, but you know, sometimes they're quite similar anyway, within smaller organisations specifically.
One would like to think that the job will get easier as, you know, society embraces and adopts more of a data protection type of culture, but maybe I'm wishful thinking there.
In ways, yeah, but then say with the likes of AI, I think that probably counteracts it at the same time, so I don't know.
It's hopefully one to think about.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully, you know, there becomes more awareness to the, you know, the lay person or the general person about data protection, and you know, not all things fall to consent. You don't have to hand your customer complaints in that sense, but you know, the wider awareness internally and with individuals will hopefully you know, smarten up internal practices and make things more streamlined. I don't know.
Joe's been awfully quiet.
He's not got an answer. You can't do that.
I can think of the questions, but
I will. I don't know. Yeah, I don't think it will necessarily change too much. I mean, it's highly unlikely that anything will get added to the, you know, the role of a DPO and its responsibilities. But I think, as Jasmine says, I think there'll just be more things that they'll have to consider in the day-to-day role as AI emerges. New challenges. And I do like to think that as time progresses, that data protection is becoming more and more known in the public eye. I think more so now, I see loads more news stories specifically, like, you know, I'm not just saying like when we're looking at privacy, I mean like on the actual news at home, you know, the Nigel Farage SAR story that came out not long ago, yeah, breaches are, you know, tending to be around more frequently. So I do think the public are now starting to move towards to understanding it and understand, so hopefully that will, I don't know, tighten up processes internally as organisations tend to, you know, you don't want your reputation being dragged through the mud, do you? So, you know, hopefully things are starting to, or employees starting to buy in, and that will make the DPO's role a little bit easier, hopefully, was the point I was trying to get to.
Well, there's been a lot of questions recently around free speech online, hasn't there? And you know, obviously the crackdown with recent events with the riots and the anti-protests and so on, and what Elon Musk has been saying online, and you know, all of that kind of thing. And I suppose that's in relation to the Online Safety Act, but it still poses the question of, you know, how people's information is going to be handled online specifically. So I think people will be much more considerate about it, and what effect that has, I can't really say. We will find out.
What's the space?
Yeah. So that is over the hour mark anyway. Thank you everyone for joining as ever. Just a quick reminder that this pass our IAPP approved, so if you want to gain your credits, you can do so. We've got a page on our website to do that. We need to keep reminding people just in case they've not been to previous ones. So we'll try our best to do that. And yeah, we will be back next week for GDPR Radio. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, guys.
See you later.